next time. In regard to the YSS, YSS does not have a contract to buy the property. We were told when went with Perkins to Jerry and Emily at the first meeting, they said, well, they couldn't issue another conditional use permit. And I didn't think that was quite right, so I went to the county attorney, and she told me, oh, yes, you can. You could have three or four conditional use permits to different people. And actually, the permit, I don't think the permit was ever issued because of the litigation, but I'm not sure about that. But even if it was issued, it would be issued to my wife because she's the landowner, because the permit goes to the landowner, not to the person that applies for it if they aren't the landowner. I, at least that's what I read, the way I read the regulations. Exactly. That's what I'm saying. So it would have been my wife that had it. So YSS point, they wouldn't have it if they were to buy the property. But YSS has not signed a contract. They refused to sign a contract to buy the property, and so we pursued other means. And my realtor had been talking to Perkins for months now, maybe years, I don't know, over a year. And after we informed him that YSS had sort of backed out. Although theoretically that still would be a possibility. The way I understand it, this litigation might be another year before it goes to trial. And actually we would like to sell our property. We've had it for sale for 3 years now. And it's an expensive piece of property. It's you look up the assessed value of the house and what the county has, it's assessed at something a little over $1.1 million, I think. And then it also has 75 acres that are all within half a mile of the city limits of Ames. Do you have any more questions about the property?
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thanks. Now, any members of the public who'd like to address this issue, please step up to the podium and give your name and address for the record. So we'll close the public hearing portion of the case. And let's see. We're on to commission discussion.
I'd like to say that seeing all of this reviewed and the discussion and things, I wholly support the concept. I wholly support the idea that a personal commercial venture should have the same rights and abilities that the federal, state, county have to build and develop and to do the same goals. I don't know that I support the proposed text as it sits. Mm-hmm. What I would like to see would be a text proposal that aligns the language of what this is. What I would like to see is a proposal that allows a private venture to align with building and usage similarly to a public. I don't know that I would be as restrictive for months of use and things like that, but I would want to see definite language in there so that it doesn't become a residential type situation. Right? How you do that, I don't know. I'm not the county attorney. But probably closer to what's in the language for what the what the county and the parks and things can do, then wide open.
I agree with that 100%.
I think we need to be careful when we say anything the public should be able to do, or the government, the local government should be able to do, a private individual should be able to do.
I mean, there's a reason why there's a catch-all paragraph in the code, and that is to allow for the public to care to deliver services, the government to deliver services.
Right.
In this case, however, the government is venturing into
a commercial
operation and
right.
close to having a monopoly on that particular type of use. I know technically it's not the right term to say monopoly, but
you're close.
exclusive rights. You know, if you read that section about what the reserve for public buildings and public structures, if we're talking about landfills and schools and city halls and that sort of thing, so it does eat at my craw a little bit that a government agency can jump out and profit from an opportunity that the market is...
But they don't allow the market to access.
Yeah.
So... Mm-hmm. I was... I think that the applicant said some things you said that she would be willing to look at some more restrictions.
Yeah.
I was particularly interested in that because you got about 79 acres. And with some of the, that could get pretty dense.
Well, let's stick to the text, not to the application for development.
Okay.
There's more information that we need to provide to the
commission. Maybe just let me lead up to then that I'm looking at supporting alternative four because it gives some time to have conversation about that. Not, you know, and you always look at a specific property. You don't want to write an ordinance for a specific property, but a specific property gives you an example, and I think that's what we're looking at right now. I'm just going to say that I'm leaning towards deferring and asking for more work on the text.
Can I add on just a little bit to your question that maybe what you would think would be reasonable limitations for any use like this, regardless of where it might land in the county?
Exactly.
Right.
You have to then broaden it.
Right.
Say, look at any application like this?
Which is why I don't necessarily want it to be to don't take the existing county cabin regulation and copy it into private.
Yeah.
Right. I'm not saying that. I would want it to be maybe a little bit more flexible than that, but structured similarly.
So we have thoroughly muddled up a good question to the applicant.
I also want to, and I know we're talking about text amendment, but I have a concern because an agency has come and proposed a very good, very needed program in the county for this land, and I don't know that it's their fault that they're in litigation because of it. That bothers me to think about revoking a conditional use permit, not to an applicant's fault.
Jerry, if this was approved, if this text amount was approved by this committee, they still have to get a conditional use permit, or they're going to have to get the site plan will have to be approved, correct?
Right. Well, ultimately, the planning and zoning commission would make a recommendation to the board of supervisors, and the board of supervisors would need to consider that.
I understand that, yes. But let's say that all happened.
They would need to apply for a conditional use permit for the commercial campground and a separate one for the bed and breakfast.
And any future applicant would have to apply for a conditional use permit and go through a procedure and special criteria to ever put a cap.
Jerry, finish your question.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Sorry. So that would mean at that point, when they came after the conditional use permit, there could be a limit put on size and or number of cabins, could there not?
Potentially. There's no reason
that
it's not addressed specifically in the
text.
What about a PUD, a planned unit?
We do have a question kind of just hanging out here in the air for the applicant regarding what
I'm
limitations you think are reasonable. Like if you could modify this a little more, what you might do?
The first one that you mentioned was a limit on the duration of stay.
and you, I don't anticipate anyone wanting to stay more than 1 month at a time. Are you wanting limits on duration of stay or duration of operation? My intent on making it year-round is with the current time frame, from a selfish nature, you miss half the football games and, you know, fall graduation, a lot of events in the fall when people are normally camping.
Agreed.
You know, so, but I'm pretty certain nobody's going to stay there when it's minus 20.
There's crazy iceberg fishermen.
Oh, there are. That's true.
Like that.
That's true.
So I that's why I'm saying I would not want it to mimic the existing code for public use. But the idea, I wouldn't look at saying you can only use them during certain months of the year or things like that. It's a commercial venture and it should be more, it has different goals than the public use does, right? But I would want, my concern is that it could become a residential facility of some sort, and that's where there's already things for development and for things like that. There's things for trailer parks or things that could be considered similar to this. That's where I would want to differentiate and say keep it a campground, keep it temporary. Not usage, but for duration, right?
Okay. So perhaps a limitation on, like, no more than 31 calendar days in a row?
Days?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know that I can legally get into the specifics of telling you what it should contain, but...
My suggestion would be no more than 31 calendar days.
Mr. Perkins, anything in and out with the issue of square footage limitation? It would seem to me that has to be in there somewhere. What would be your thoughts on a square footage limitation?
My first
relative
one.
relative to the area that it's on. So like,
okay.
X number of occupants per.
Well, I think I limit before I took off the square footage limitation. I'll just tell you what I had originally. I had a limitation of 750 square foot of enclosed area.
Okay.
The way I got to 750 square feet is that would easily allow a two-room type of a setting where parents would be in one room and maybe bunks for kids.
And
speaking selfishly from a parent, that's kind of what I was thinking.
I see that thinking more broadly than your development.
Okay.
Thinking of that I would prefer for the text to talk about structures per acre or occupants per acre so that it could more easily...
Okay.
It could be more flexible, right? You could build one large cabin on more acreage versus smaller cabins on, you know, fewer.
I wonder... Sorry.
Looking forward to potential text to that could apply more generically for the county.
I'm wondering how the health department regulations with the septic systems, how that can all kind of align.
Water problem.
Well, I know, but you know they're
separate regulations.
They are, but they're kind of related. How many units did they say that you could put on?
Well, that would be a CUP related.
I'm just trying to like see how all kind of balances out in like the big picture of regulation.
Well, you'd have to test the soil first. Sell it first. I mean, it's a question that can't be answered with.
That's CUP. That
so you're saying that's site specific.
That's absolutely application and development and site specific. What I'm looking for is not site specific. So I don't want specific square footage. I want.
Okay.
Something closer to what could be applied generically.
Absolutely. Jerry.
Jerry, do we have to act on this tonight? I mean, do we have to act on it, or can we ask him to come back?
Alternative 4.
that's one of the options.
I mean, I would move for alternate number four. Second. Ask the applicant to come back.
We have a motion by Cable and a second by Merkin for alternative number four. Is there discussion on the motion?
I think that's most reasonable.
My only comment would be, I think that that's what you're looking for, is the ability to modify the text and make it more palatable.
More palatable. So,
right.
Easily done. I'll have it for you next month. It is monthly, guys.
One of the challenges with alternative number four in any situation is that we give the staff and the applicant enough direction that we're not just kicking the can down the road another month. And so I would ask staff, do you feel like you have any direction at all right now?
Hopefully we have audio.
I think the general vibe is that we're not ready to reject the proposal out of hand yet. That there may be a version that we're willing to consider more seriously.
It's not what you're leaning towards in a minute.
Is there a way you can say yes to this?
Yeah, I'm leaning towards approval of the right text.
We have a motion on the table, and as long as staff feels like they have some direction and that the applicant isn't completely lost on where to go with this.
No, I think I know what I need to do. I need to take my amendment as written, put some reasonable limitations with regards to the duration of stay of individuals and a limit on the number of occupants per acre, and come back to this board with those limitations and proceed from there.
My input would be...
We have a motion on the table, so let's not give the applicant... I mean, we want to make sure they have a direction in hand, but we can't write the ordinance for them. So if there's no other discussion on the motion, then we ask for a roll call vote.
Cable?
Aye.
Merkin?
Aye.
Steele?
Yes.
McBride?
And we are voting on four. Four, four.
That's correct.
Yes. Yes.
Yes. Smith?
Yes.
Sherwood?
Yes. We have a passing motion. And we will reconsider this when we have a modified proposal. Thank you for your time tonight. All right. We are on to CUP 11-17. RPM Access LLC, Meteorological Power System.
Can we get a little break? Or can I take a little break?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Why don't we recess for 5 minutes and we'll come right back. Call our meeting back to order. And Emily, do you have a presentation for us?
I absolutely do.
Awesome.
The next case on our agenda is a conditional use permit application for a meteorological tower. The application is submitted by RPM Access. This proposed location of the tower is Section 13 in Union Township. The contact here is Matt Garwood. He is an authorized representative of RPM Access.
Let me go away.
This is, again, a new conditional use permit application. The current request is for a meteorological tower, which is a component of a commercial wind energy conversion system. And the purpose of it is to collect wind data to determine the feasibility of a commercial wind energy conversion system. As you probably remember, about 6 months ago or so, we brought another meteorological tower to you, and that was a permanent tower that was acted as kind of a control variable, sort of a way to ensure that the turbines were...
Yourself at 30, right?
Yep, were functioning the way that they are meant to. This is a little bit different because the tower is proposed. It's a temporary tower, and it's to determine whether or not the site is feasible for future wind energy conversion. Okay? So the tower type is a monopole with guide wires. Again, the temporary tower with a height of 199 feet 5 inches, it is less than 200 feet. So the location, the proposed location of this tower is just over 2 miles northeast of Cambridge in Union Township, on the west side of Union, east side of Union Township. The current zoning of the property is A1, it is completely surrounded by A1 property, or A1 zoning. The current land use of the property is currently in the CRP, Conservation Reserve Program, and all the surrounding land is in agricultural program. So this is the proposed location on the parcel. We have 305th Street here, and then 610th Avenue here. The tower, and we'll look at a setback map in a second, but is in located within the CRP ground, and is 1,600 feet approximately to the nearest residential property. Of course, further than that to the actual dwelling itself. Here's a site plan submitted by the applicant. They're proposing a location of about 260 feet east of 610th Avenue and just over 1,000 feet south of 305th Street. And then it's approximately 250 feet from the south property line. So here's a site plan looking at kind of the layout of the tower and the guide wires. The proposed tower would be here in the center, and then there'd be three guide wires on each side coming out in four directions. The furthest guide wire anchor would be about 164 feet from the center of the tower. So this is a kind of what a typical Met tower would look like on this image was provided to us by the applicant. And then here's an elevation drawing of the proposed tower. Again, it's about 198 feet, and then with the lightning rod on top, it would be 199. And then the guide wires would extend out about 164 feet from the center of the tower. So there's some site photos. This is looking southeast along 610th Avenue at the subject property. There is the dwelling to the southeast of the proposed tower location. This is looking northeast toward 305th Street. I'm standing on 610th Avenue here. And then the intersection of 305th Street and 610th Avenue. And then this is looking west from the subject property, as you can see, all in agricultural row crops. So, in terms of the standards of approval for a conditional use permit, compatibility, the proposed location of the Met Tower is over 2 miles from the City of Cambridge corporate limits. The Met Tower is a component of a commercial wind energy conversion system, which is permitted if granted as a conditional use in the A1 district. The property on which the Met Tower is proposed is the Conservation Reserve Program. And then, as I said before, the surrounding property is all agricultural row crops. All setback requirements, as listed in the supplemental standards for Met Towers under the Commercial Wind Energy Conversion System, are met by this proposed site plan. Second item, transition. The tower will be located 240 feet east of 610th Avenue and about 1,100 feet south of 305th Street right of way. The nearest dwelling is, again, over a quarter of a mile to the southeast of the proposed tower. The monopole structure and guy wires do not have any climbing apparatuses and are not climbable. The applicant for the prior to the meeting, the applicant did provide you with a notarized statement from the property owner consenting to installation of this temporary met tower without security fencing around it. That is something that is an option in our work. In terms of traffic, really traffic to this tower is minimal. But in order to install the monopole tower, there would be a pickup truck and a small trailer delivering the tower and related accessories. They will use an existing field entrance off of 610th Avenue, which is just south of the proposed tower site. Installation will only take about 2 to 3 days, so very minimal impact. The maintenance visits will be rare, maybe once every 6 months, and will only involve a pickup truck. The terms of the lease agreement between the property owner and RPM Access does include a compensation for any damage to crops, although in this specific case, the property is in the CRP program, so that's not really applicable. In terms of parking and loading, the parking during construction will be completely on private property. There will be no parking or equipment storage in the right of way. No signs of lighting, signs or lighting are proposed for this met tower. Due to the height of the tower, which is less than 200 feet, the Federal Aviation Administration restrictions do not apply for lighting. The proposed tower will be marked as recommended by the FAA in order to enhance, increase the visibility of the structure in rural areas. Particularly as it might have an impact on like crop airplanes and sort of stuff. The coloring will be altered in advance of aviation orange and white, the tower, and then there will be high visibility sleeves on the guide wires near the anchor points as well as near the connection points to the tower. High visibility aviation orange spherical markers will also be placed on the guidewires. Environmental protection. The environmental impact to the site is anticipated to be limited. There will not be any soil moved or turned with the installation of this tower. The tower itself does stand on a 3 foot by 3 foot square steel plate that is set on top of the soil. Anchors in four directions will be secured about 5 feet below, but again, that is frozen from the regular. So there's not an impact on the soil. No great changes needed there at all. There's no concrete used for the foundation of the tower or the guy wire anchors. After the term of the lease with the property owner, RPM Access will remove all components of the met tower and restore the site to its original condition. So analysis, if the commission concludes that all of the above development criteria are met, it must recommend approval of the application unless it concludes that if completed as proposed, there is a strong probability the development will not adequately safeguard the health, safety, and general welfare of persons residing or working in adjoining or surrounding property, impair an adequate supply, including quality of light and air to surrounding property, unduly increase congestion on the road or hazard from fire, flood, or similar danger, diminish or impair established property values on adjoining or surrounding property, and not be in accord with the intent of the land development regulations or the county the original application, and the applicant provided the information to us. We did send notification letters to surrounding property owners within a quarter mile of the proposed location of the meteorological tower. On December 21st, we did not receive any comments. The recommended conditions, these are, as stated in your staff report, I did clarify with the engineering office that the applicant has taken care of everything they need to do through that office, so I'm recommending that be number four be removed. And then also, planning and development staff, we recommend approval of this conditional use permit application with the following conditions. Meteorological tower and all equipment must be removed at or before November 20th of 2019, and that is the same time frame as in the contract with the property owner. An extension of this time frame will require modification to the conditional use permit, depending on the time frame could change slightly. We do request that a modification application be submitted if that does need to change. A 911 address will be required to be issued at the access point for the Met Tower. And a decommissioning plan and financial security must be submitted prior to the issuance of the zoning permit for the Met Tower. The applicant did send something to me this afternoon. We need the county attorney's office to look it over. So we will leave that condition for now. So, your alternatives are here. Staff is recommending alternative number two, approval with conditions.
Thanks, Emily. Any questions for the staff?
I have one. When we approved the interoperability tower, I remember a guideline or requirement that it had to be 150% of its height away from any highways, or is it not? Is that not?
That is true for the under communication towers. That conditional use permit supplemental standard. The section we're permitting this under is the commercial wind energy conversion system. Because it is a Met Tower and has those functions, ultimately we kind of went back and forth on what section to permit it under.
What's the rationale of having 150% on one kind of tower and not another?
Good question.
Sorry.
I don't know the rationale on that. We discussed quite a bit why that might be different, and we did not come up with a answer.
But the reality is then that we have two places, two separate requirements, two different requirements in different parts of our zoning ordinance. The towers was not really a good answer for us.
Was the other tower permanent?
Mm-hmm.
And this is no.
This is a little temporary.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me?
This tower is to be temporary.
That's what I said.
What's the setback on a wind turbine? More or less than 150% of the height of the tower. Because that's essentially what you're calling this, right? You're calling this wind energy.
I know the answer to that question.
You can hold on just
110%.
Permit it under. You base it on how it looks and feels, you base it on its function.
Yes,
In the definition of wind energy conversion systems, you see language about net towers.
You do.
So they can certainly use this. We can apply this chapter.
Okay.
But it's also a tower, so we also think that we can apply conversions to tower section as well.
Okay. Other questions for Scott? Applicant, would you like to address the commission?
We have nothing further.
Okay. Would you be open to questions if you have any?
Sure.
Okay. Any other questions for the applicant that haven't been covered by the staff? Okay. Is there anyone here from the public that would like to speak on the issue?
Yes.
If you give us your name and address for the record, please, that'd be great.
Yeah, my name is Randy Collings, and I'm associated with the wind turbine, the Met Tower you were talking about previously, south of Highway 30. I'm 100% in favor of the wind turbine stuff. I think there's a matter of safety involved. Only if I think the tower needs to be lit. The tower needs to be lit because there's four pipelines directly to the west. You saw them in one of your pictures. Plane flies that route at least once a week, if not more often than that. It is a low-flying airplane inspecting the pipelines. Okay? I do believe the tower should be lit. Only because of that. Pipelines weren't there, I'd say go for it. But I do believe there's a safety issue involved in this. Only for that. Cope Pipelines and William Pipelines are right there to the west.
So would they ever inspect the pipelines at night, though?
Early mornings. And they do fly low. They fly very low. I just happen to think about that, you know, seeing a picture of the pipelines that I have to deal with all the time anyway. But
the Dakota Access.
I'm sorry?
The Dakota Access Pipeline. Is that
no, this is no. Williams Pipeline and Koch Brothers okay. Pipelines.
Okay.
Come out of Kansas City, I believe.
Where
they go through Des Moines, and they're going up to Minneapolis. So, but there's four pipelines right there that they're inspected at least weekly, if not more often. That's all I got to say.
Thank you.
I'd just like to note that our code does cite FAA regulations where it says the tower is less than 200 feet. We have to go with those regulations, which do not require any artificial lighting. Separate from that, though, to
add conditions to the permit. Okay. Any other members of the public like to speak? Okay. You mentioned the other Met Tower. Was that permitted as a under the wind energy rather than the communications tower? So we would be acting consistently with previous practice.
As a bonus.
Okay, discussion from the commission?
I have a question about the FAA and the lighting. Did we just go with the FAA regulation, or did we contact the FAA and ask their input?
Can we read it for the record? I think it's helpful.
Please.
Lighting. CWAC sites shall not be artificially lighted except to the extent required by the FAA or other applicable authority. Lighting, including lighting intensity and frequency of strobe, shall adhere to but not exceed requirements established by Federal Aviation Administration permits and regulations. Red strobe lights are preferred for nighttime illumination to reduce impact on migrating birds. Red pulsating incandescent lights should be avoided. Exceptions may be made for meteorological towers where concerns exist relative to aerial spray patterns.
I think what we need to get to is whether or not we will be exceeding the FAA requirements by requiring lighting when their standard is less than 200 feet in height and not required to be lighted for that.
So to be clear, our code says, it doesn't just say use FAA regulations, it says we shall not require lighting unless required by FAA.
And our first sentence shall not be artificially lighted except to the extent required by the FAA.
Okay. So, is there any reason why it would not be possible to work with emergency management and get them to contact the two pipelines
and tell them this could this will be out there? I mean, sometimes it seems like we take the hard way to make sure.
Right. Yeah, as a point of note, that pipeline does turn and go across the road just shortly north of that area. So it is on the east side of that road, right north of it.
Okay.
Which is directly in line with the pipeline. I'm looking at that.
Thanks.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. I agree. I don't want to impose a new burden of creating lighting where the FAA doesn't require it. But if there is a safety concern with, you know, low-flying aircraft that do fly an unconventional route, it would be beneficial. It would be in everybody's best interest to at least give them a heads up.
We can communicate with that Ames Airport staff, emergency management.
Yeah. I think specifically since the aircraft inspectors are the responsibility of the pipeline, if we give the pipeline that information, they can do what they want with it.
Are there other questions or any other discussion from the commission, or do we have a motion?
I'll move to approve the CUP 11-17 RPM access meeting that tower.
Is there a second?
With the conditions proposed by staff.
Is there a second?
So we're at number two.
Number two.
Correct. I'll turn it to number two. Is there a second?
Second.
Is there discussion on the motion? Everybody clear that Marvin moved on alternative number two as recommended by staff? Could we get a roll call vote, please?
Next.
Yes.
Cable?
Yes.
Steel?
Yes.
McBride?
Yes.
Men?
Yes.
Merkin?
Yes.
Sherwood?
Yes.
Motion carries. Thanks for coming in. Thanks for your comments.
Thanks for the additional input.
All right.
I have a question, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
Jerry, how long will this take?
Let me ask you if you think this is feasible. Can we be done with the presentation by about 5 till and leave about 10 minutes for comments from the commission and just set that time limit on? Is that possible? Would that be acceptable with everybody?
Somebody enforces it.
Oh boy. All right. Let's go for it.
Okay, Andy Sermon Fringe Plan. The reason why we're addressing this is we've got some new planning and zoning commission members. It's a separate land use planning document separate from our C2C plan, which addresses the unincorporated area of the county. This is unique and specific to the area, which is a 2-mile limit outside the city of Ames and involves the Story County, City of Ames, and the City of Gilbert. We do receive a lot of requests to review changes involving annexations, text amendments. On a staff level, we review a lot of requests for subdivisions, zoning permit applications. We've had a few examples where the Planning and Zoning Commission recommended a runway where the board of supervisors took a different direction. So the goal really is to try to help provide information, give you a little background and help you with future decisions and cases that come along. So what I'm just going to touch on is what's addressed in state law with regards to subdivision notification. A little bit of history on the plan, get into some of the details, information from our department as far as its effectiveness, and a little bit of information about something that we're working on internally with regard to setting the land use between the Ames and the open. So this map represents the area that we're talking about. It's a 2-mile limit. extends out from the Ames corporate limit, which is the blue line. Everything that's highlighted, except for the east area, we went through about a year ago a east industrial annexation and amendment that part of that was a request to change the actual boundary. So the boundary now in this location is 590th Avenue, which is also the joint jurisdiction between the city of Ames and the city of Nevada.
But Nevada is not a part of the urban fringe.
Nevada is not a part of the.
Will that change after the eastern annexation?
No, that boundary
still
is
not a part of the.
That boundary is just stationary, doesn't evolve, basically.
Correct. The only way that the boundaries change is if it's brought up before the three entities and there's action taken.
But not to the east, which is, I think, his question, because that boundary's been set at 590.
590 is the eastern limit, which I'm trying to show with this. That line right here is 590. So what you're seeing here is a representation of the zoning district. So if you look inside the 2 mile limit, you'll see that there's not a lot of color there. Most of the area is zoned A1 agricultural district, and with that designation you see aerial imagery. What you see that's red would be commercial light industrial zoning. There's some there, a little pocket in there. Green is agribusiness. What else? The blue would be the heavy industrial district. Yellow represents the R1 residential transitional district. So most of what we deal with from a zoning standpoint is A1 agricultural district. So uses that would be permitted in an agricultural district. So what does that mean in terms of the county's zoning code? Are things that you would expect, you know, the crop production, the livestock production. You can have a single family dwelling. Cemeteries are permitted. Public and private stables are permitted. Parks and forest preserves are permitted. So before you can have an accessory use, which is what we're going to get into, you have to have a principal permitted use. That's the way that our ordinance is set up. So if you have an established principal permitted use, then you might have an accessory building, a home business, which has a separate set of standards. You have the wind energy conversion systems, which Emily went through, also solar, that are site specific. These are not like the farms that would produce energy for a neighborhood or for the community at large, but they primarily provide benefit for the on-site use. And then what we have is something called conditional use permits. Separate applications, separate submittal. These do come before the Planning and Zoning Commission before they go on to the Board of Adjustment for Action. I'm not going to go through all of them, but golf courses are something that you could potentially get a conditional use permit to do that activity. Campgrounds we touched on, nurseries, bed and breakfast, churches, dog kennels, things like that. You might be able to accomplish those requests with a conditional use permit submittal. They're routed internally. Staff provides input. They come to Planning and Zoning Commission before they are actually ultimately addressed by the Board of Adjustment. So state law under Code of Iowa Chapter 354.9 governs the notification process with regard to subdivisions. And it basically requires the county to notify any city that's within 2 miles of a subdivision, and for the county, it's a division of a single parcel into three separate parcels. There's three separate lots. It also says that if the city and the county have ordinances regulating the division, the regulations should be similar so that there's not confusion between the entities, that there's not confusion with the applicant. It also says that the city or the county can waive their authority to review the subdivision plan, or you can enter into a 2080 agreement, which is what took place with this Ames Urban Fringe plan. It's a 2080 agreement document that provides details about the role of each of the three entities with regard to subdivisions based on what the designation is, where the location of the project is. There's a process that's set out as far as what you do to amend the plan and so forth. It also talks about a resolution that needs to be adopted and recorded. And then I just point out that the City of Ames has an ordinance that gives them authority to review class of survey, which is typically a division once into two separate parcels, but it's primarily for the rural urban transitional areas. And I'll get into that in a minute. So history of the plan, there was a time that Ames, Gilbert, Story County all had separate comprehensive plans that identified the future land use. But there was issues with overlapping regulations, inconsistencies with policies, and we were finding out that there was impacts to rural areas and agricultural areas. There's some history between 1990 and 2000 that's provided that approximately 12 acres of land a year during that time period was being changed to single-family dwellings that were on critical resource, natural resource areas. 35 acres per year were changed within an eighth of a mile from a waterway, and 30 acres per year of soils with poor rating for septic systems were changed in use. Lastly, there's a statistic that 18 acres of land per year was developed within areas they designated natural areas under the Ames inventories. Details on the plan. The plan was adopted in 2006. Again, it involves Ames, Gilbert, Story County. There was a 28E agreement, which comes from Code of Iowa 28E, and it gives, that chapter gives the authority to governmental entities to work together on shared services. And in this case, it has to be a planning document, land use planning document. So the document is broken up into primary designated areas with subcategories. So the first primary area is rural service, agricultural conservation areas, which, again, for the unincorporated area, that's primarily what you're going to see. Some of the subcategories are ag and farm service. You have rural residential, which allows some limited single-family dwellings in a rural setting where there's limited infrastructure. There's a park and rec designation. The only one that I'm aware of in that plan is the Ames Golf and Club, Golf and Country Club. That's the only designation for that. The other category is rural urban transitional area. That's the main category. It talks about rural character with an urban setting, in future urban services and development standards, annexation agreements are typically required. This is where the Irons was a part of, it was that designation, west of the Ames Golf Country Club. So you've got priority transitional, residential, residential development at an urban scale, at urban infrastructure standards, rural transitional residential, rural residential development with limited infrastructure. Then it goes into some commercial and industrial designations. Highway-oriented commercial are found along highways or arterials in urban areas. You've got an industrial designation. Natural areas are typically where you see your vegetated areas, trees, creeks, rivers, it's where the wildlife habitat is located. There's a goal of preserving those areas focus on minimizing impact to stormwater drainage. Industrial Reserve Research Park, ISU Research Park, ag subsurface mining, that's where you're going to find Martin Marietta on the north end of the city. And then agricultural long-term industrial reserve, that's what much of the area east of the I-35 between Lincoln Way and north of Highway 30 was, that was changed to planned industrial. The last one is urban service area. These are what we consider to be prime. You're going to see those designated areas close to the city limits. And before an area can be annexed, it's got to have this urban service area designation. Subcategories are urban residential. It's reserved for residential growth. We've got planned industrial, reserved for clustering of industrial uses that limit impacts on environmental and natural residential uses. We've got commercial nodes. One is more of a community node that is to be in an area that comprises maybe 40 to 75 acres. Again, it serves a regional need with various uses compared to the convenience commercial node, which is more neighborhood oriented, serving anywhere from 2,000 to 3,000 people. So you're going to have your, like, retail uses, banking, coffee shops, things of that nature. So this provides a little more detail. You see the city of Ames, corporate limits in red, the Ames River Fringe boundary in blue. Again, the categories are ag conservation area, that's the light green area. Again, most of what we're dealing with outside the city of Ames in this area is ag and farm service. That's a predominant designation. Then that goes into rural urban transitional area, that's the yellow area that you see. Again, the irons was a part of that. See a little bit over in here. And then an urban service area, it's kind of a buff brown color. And again, you'll notice that those are close to the incorporated limits of the city, so Millbury and the city of Maine. So again, those areas are prime to be annexed and to, you know, if they're going to get annexed, then they're going to meet the city standards for development.
Curie, wasn't there a proposed recently the convenience commercial node up across from the irons, right?
Yeah.
It's not on this map, but
road,
right, and George Washington Carver.
Right, right.
Okay.
And that one, I believe, did just for that intersection. This is just part of the actual 28 agreement, just to show you. You see the signatures of Story County, City of Ames, and City of Gilbert representatives. Again, this is 2011. First page, again, 2080 is when the Code of Iowa allows entities to work together for a common shared service. In this case, it's land use planning. I just want to point out some provisions in the document. This is under 5.1 County Zoning Regulations. It says nothing in this agreement shall be construed or applied to limit the county's legislative authority or discretion in adopting or amending its land use regulations. So, if it's something that's in the unincorporated area and it's something that meets the county zoning district, then for the most part we have the authority to issue zoning permits. We also believe that it gives us the authority to issue conditional use permits that are reviewed by the Planning and Zoning Commission and ultimately acted on by the Board of Adjustment. Under 5.1.2, it talks about official zoning map, which gets to amendments. This block basically states that if we receive a request to amend the zoning and it's not in compliance with the designated area within the plan, that issue needs to be addressed first in the plan, which involves the three entities. So any change to the plan would have to be approved by the City Council of Ames, City of Gilbert, and approved by the Board of Supervisors before we can address zoning change in the county, which that would be before the Planning and Zoning Commission and ultimately back to the Board of Supervisors. This talks about subdivision regulations, rural service, and ag conservation. It's telling you that the cities are waiving their authority to review. These are, for the most part, simple divisions, oftentimes no more than two dwelling lots. The second part is rural urban transitional areas. Basically, everyone has the authority to review these, but with the language in the plan, these are oftentimes They're not rural residential, but they're next tier. And so if there's that likelihood that they're to be annexed, then it basically indicates that we should be yielding to the city that has that authority to regulate that proposed project. You know, the Irons was an example of that. And it was an apples to oranges kind of situation because the development met the city of Ames' standards, but did not meet the county standards, and then we had probably four or five alternative compliance requests that we dealt with separately. So, again, transitional areas typically fall to the city who has a plan to annex where their future home or long-term home will be. Urban service areas, again, those areas are prime for annexation and to be developed. Highlighting this again, basically states in these transitional areas, it says in establishing a process for subdivision review in a rural urban transitional area land use class, the three jurisdictions acknowledge the primacy of cities' interest in regulating development in areas that the cities may at some future moment annex. So again, we think that gives cities the, you know, that they're in the front seat on the regulatory side. All three entities do have the right to review, but if it's an area that is ultimately going to be annexed, the primary reviewer should be the city. This talks about the amendment process. To request an amendment, you have to go to the city of Ames to request that. It takes two of the three entities to give a thumbs up that they will accept an application. If you get the majority, then it goes to the basically to the staff for consideration, and then on to the planning and zoning commissions of the cities and the board supervisors, and then ultimately to the city councils and the board supervisors to make a change. So that's an amendment to the plan. If it's amended, it's a happy face. If it doesn't get amended, it's a sad face.
Jerry, about how many minutes do you want to give us?
I'll wrap it up here. So, as far as our view, I don't think we should take it for granted. I'm sure it took a lot to get the three entities together at the table to start talking about working together on a planning document. These, as you know, can be complex. We think it, for the most part, has kind of provided that general growth and direction that we need, but it's going to be subject to change. We have a process built into the language for dealing with change. It's inevitable. And then, like I said, we're working on part of our work program. We're supposed to look at the land use, North Ames, South of Gilbert. What prompted that was the high school, the paving of high. We haven't looked at it for 10 years. We review a lot of requests for subdivisions, zoning permit applications, and then the city of Ames is a sanitary sewer study kind of prompted it. But we're looking at a lot of different levels, including land use, road system, road improvements, natural resources, urban growth areas. We're looking at development patterns. You know, there's a lot of existing developments that can potentially be extended. Look at where the utilities are, zoning district designations. We've gathered information on bus routes, and we've had discussions with school districts on growth plans. So it's something that we're going to have before the Planning and Zoning Commission. So that, I'd be happy.
I would add emergency services to that list.
And can we go back to the list?
List of this?
Yeah. Is this now the time where we talk about making
sure? Sure, go ahead.
Instead of maybe roads, this is just like, maybe it's splitting hairs, but just a suggestion. Maybe consider transportation instead, so then you're looking at, you know, the whole system rather than just the roads in particular.
Vehicles.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what the future of transit holds in this area, or bicycle and pedestrian improvements, that sort of thing. Okay, just wanted to make sure.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Okay, cool. All right. Awesome.
Any other questions for Scott?
Were you saying that the urban fringe boundaries don't necessarily get moved when these annexes?
Yeah, they're supposed to stay consistent with annexation changes, unless there's a specific request to make a change, which we had that with that East Industrial expansion, annexation, and
so the 2 miles from the in city limits is not really the, that's what it was originally set, but that's not necessarily how it's.
Yeah, when we have annexation, the boundaries are not supposed to change with this.
Seems like maybe when this study area, you're talking about more the area north of Ames, right, with this study that you're.
Yeah, we're looking at the northern limits of the city of Ames.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you know, and actually, you know, we're looking at, when I say north, we're looking north, at northwest, northeast, and then probably like 170th. We're looking at a pretty large area.
So, the Nevada and Ames' boundaries, are they going to eventually meet there, and then the county is going to be kind of out of the picture in between this?
With that east annexation,
they don't
touch.
Okay.
And when that boundary was set, that's that 590th, that's basically where everybody agreed and said, we're going to annex up to that point, and then then we're done.
The county is, or everyone's done talking.
Ames is not going to go further east than 590.
Okay.
And that was an agreement with Ames and Nevada and the county.
Okay.
Thanks, Jerry.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I think that was good. I'm glad we got it in. All right, we are down to staff comments. Anything new?
I don't really have anything other than to give you a copy of the work program that we worked on in December. We did add a comment, which we put in the mid-portion of our action. We had that discussion about looking at the roads and subdivisions, try to get a handle on, you know, which ones are dedicated publicly, look at tribal driveway situations, also, and then try to figure out, get a handle on, like, an inventory of signage. So that's what our goal and our task will be, to provide that information to the planning and zoning commission and the supervisors, and then possibly that might turn a little work program for 2019.
Commission comments. I just want to once again welcome Kathy. And Kathy, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
I grew up on a farm, South Colo, Hickory Grove. In fact, I swam where Hickory Grove is today. Been in my family for over 100 years. And so I work as a crop insurance agent for Farm Credit Services of America now. I was up here in Nevada for 24 years in Midwest Insurance, doing all sorts of different kinds of insurance. It's for the fall life, from the combine and the tractor. So, I'm busy sometimes.
Well, welcome, Kathy, and thank you for being willing to serve. Appreciate it.
For 5 years.
And I'm retiring.
Yeah.
Kathy, Kathy asked a question earlier about when we were on a break after some of the discussions and things about what's appropriate and not appropriate for talking to applicants or landowners and things. And so just probably a reminder to all of us
you're going to tell
that. I don't make the rules, but there are rules for the state of Iowa about, because these meetings are held in a public forum, that any of the information gathering or discussions need to be held within that public forum. So we get the agenda and we can go out and drive and look at properties to, help us
understand where and what we're talking about, but it's not appropriate to, you know, knock on the door and ask the homeowner's question, you know, the property owner's questions or, you know, things like that pertaining to, you know, any of the applications.
And we're always open and very interested in answering questions. Okay.
So outside of these meetings, it's still appropriate to contact staff, but there are conduit with things outside of these meetings for any of the whole activities.
When's Gary Taylor's next seminar?
That's the other thing. I think it's in May, which I forgot to say. I'm sorry. The ISU Extension puts on a pretty good training for Planning and Zoning Commission members and Board of Adjustment members, and it's really kind of geared to new people, but we open that to all members, and that's something that the county will pay for, and we can provide that information.
Details like open meetings and who's appropriate to talk to.
Yeah. And they provide food.
All right.
Credit, maybe.
Any other
comments? Yeah, he keeps it pretty light too, and has some pretty good jokes.
He's entertaining. Any other comments from the commission?
I want to say something. I did talk to that woman, the applicant, out there in the corridor. If that's what you're thinking, she was looking at me and she waved at one point during their presentation. And I thought, I want to figure out if I know her.
I never
in case anybody wondered, because I did, I thought, because I should tell somebody if I know her. No, I didn't. As soon as she opened her mouth, I thought, no, that's not the voice I would have equated with that face.
No, it wasn't anything in particular.
No.
It's not infrequent that when you leave these meetings that people are out there waiting and want to talk and things. And it's not inappropriate to talk to people. It's just inappropriate to discuss the application.
So that's what that seminar will go through, is all those conflicts of interest that might arise. It's pretty useful information.
And when is this again?
I believe it's in May.
Any other comments from the commission?
Motion to close.
We have a motion to adjourn. Is there a second?
Second.
Did you hear that? Motion by Smith, second by Merkin. We stand adjourned.